Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. We are coming to you from Roanoke, Virginia's Generic Magic Festival, and this is episode 17, Harry Potter and the Festivals Which Must Not Be Named, Harry in Pop Culture. Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. We are talking today with a variety of people who are involved in Roanoke's Generic Magic Festival, and we're going to be talking about festivals which must not be named and Harry Potter in popular culture. We will be talking with scholars Louise Freeman, Amy Sturgis, and Lana Whited. And we have a lot to talk about today. My co-host today is Emily Strand. She is instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing, author of Mass 101, Liturgy and Life, and she's the author of articles and presentations on the Harry Potter series and a Jedi Master.
Thank you.
How have you enjoyed the festival today, Emily?
It has been awesome. My head is so full of so many awesome insights that I'm going to have to,
And we were mostly at the academic part of the festival.
We were.
Magical education.
Kind of exclusively. I'm going to admit that exclusively I was at the, I have absolutely zero souvenirs to take home, material souvenirs, that is, to my child. But that's okay, because I have lots of good ideas that I'll share with him.
That's right. You got educated.
Yeah.
Magically educated.
Exactly.
Very good. Well, let me introduce our special guest today. First up, we have Louise Freeman, professor of psychology at Mary Baldwin University and a board-certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the show, Louise.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And we're also going to be talking with Amy Sturgis. She was the keynote speaker for the festival, and she's the author of many books, and she teaches at Lenoir Rhine University. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here.
And Lana Whited, who is professor of English at Ferrum College and director of the Honors Program. She is one of the organizers of the Generic Magic Festival in Roanoke, so we will get the real insider's view. Welcome, Lana.
Thank you, Katie, and thanks for being here.
Really, my pleasure. What a fun day it was. And like Emily said, I felt like I really came away with a lot of new insights about Harry Potter, and it was also fun just to be with a bunch of Potterheads.
Yes.
You know, people who are thinking about it.
Who match the intensity. We talked about matching our fanish intensity. It's sometimes it's hard to find in our everyday lives. Those people who are willing to nerd out to a particular level. But here, you know, this has been a day of being able to do that.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, we are going to be talking today about Harry Potter in the popular culture, and these festivals are definitely a big part of that. And one of the things that is, I think, as you said, there's this intensity that we have. We are fans. We are also scholars. And so I thought I would just start by asking everyone, you know, to what extent do you consider yourself a fan or a scholar who's at some distance or remove? There's Henry Jenkins's term that's ACA-fan, which is an academic who's also a fan, so there's some crossover. Emily, what do you think? How would you characterize yourself?
Well, I can get behind Henry Jenkins' ACA-fan term. I can get behind that because I definitely started as a fan, and I read the books when I was in graduate school, so I was not, certainly not yet an academic, becoming an academic, but I read the books and was a fan, and I listened to podcasts like Pottercast and like MuggleNet Academia was huge. Anything I could kind of get my hands on, Travis Prinzi's old podcast, the Hogshead Pubcast was a staple. And then eventually I just like, you know, I would be running around the treadmill or running around the track, listening to these podcasts, and I'd be like arguing back, you know, and shouting out my own ideas, you know, and then eventually, it was through Dr. Sturgis's course on Harry Potter that I published my first academic piece on Harry Potter. And then I kind of got into the academic vein, but I still consider myself a fan first and foremost. You know, I'm like, my proudest moments are when one of my students comes to me with a hand crocheted golden snitch, and it's like at the end of the semester, and it's like, oh wow, I made this for you. It's like, wow, you know, because she, like, I could tell that she related to me as a fan, you know, that we're both really big fans of this. So I like the ACA fan. I'll own the ACA fan term, because I'm definitely a fan first and then an academic kind of as I evolved.
What about you, Amy? Would you consider yourself, I mean, you're such a scholarly presence. Right. You've written so much. You do a lot with Tolkien scholarship and so on. And would you consider yourself at a kind of intellectual remove, or are you very much a fan? What would you say?
No, I will definitely go throw in with Emily there and own ACA fan. In part, I don't think anyone does good work about a subject in which they're completely disinterested, right? Or uninterested even. Also, the whole concept of Henry Jenkins's work has been influential for me for a long time, in the sense of understanding participatory culture and
right.
You know, textual poaching. The idea of storytelling being a two-way street between the creator and the audience. And I started out as a fan before I ever went to school, right? And so it wasn't for Harry Potter, but the mindset of wanting to spend my life on something I loved made sense to me. And I also think that the people who love given texts are also going to be very, very careful in their criticism, and they're going to pick it apart and take it seriously. So I don't see the idea of caring about works being in any way opposed to the idea of being critical about them. So I like Jenkins' work, and I'll go with ACA fan.
Yeah, you know, I think this too, that there, I always say when somebody studies the Civil War in history and is a Civil War historian, they don't do that because they don't really care much about the Civil War. They're kind of a fan of that particular history, but we cover that with, you know, this is my academic expertise. But there's a fan resonance there, I think.
If you're not a buff or an aficionado of something, and you're studying it, maybe you want to rethink your life choices a little bit and find something you do care about.
Yeah, life advice from Amy.
I just wanted to point out that Amy's wearing a Time Turner and Emily's wearing a prefect badge, so I don't think we'd let either of them get away with saying, oh, I'm just a scholar.
Disinterested.
I feel so seen right now.
You know, that's so funny, though. But, I mean, let's say, like, you have your copyright-free witch shirt on.
I do.
From the festival.
Yep.
Louise has a T-shirt that says always with the A is the Deathly Hallows mark. And although I don't have – I've covered it up a little bit, but I am wearing dark mark socks. So I do have my little contribution there, too. There's a fan element there that we're all embracing.
That's a little scary.
A little frightening fan.
I wear it when I give tests. Louise.
Well, I hadn't heard the term ACA fan until about 5 minutes ago, but I it's an interesting term, and I guess I can claim that one as well. But one of the things I've seen and what the research shows from psychology is that when we talk about a work of literature changing social cognition, impacting empathy, or helping people feel less prejudiced, this only happens for people who get emotionally drawn up into the book or get personally involved with their book. And I don't think you can get much more personally involved than coming to a festival like this and, you know, dressing like the characters and putting on your prefect badges and your Deathly Hallows earrings and all this type of
having
stuff.
Having pumpkin juice at the feast the night before.
Whatever it is. It's when you engage readers on that level, that's, to me, what fandom is. And, I mean, it's a great thing, and I personally enjoy both studying the fans themselves and the book that they're fans of. So,
right, I would agree with that. I think the fandom, to me, the fandom part of it, the participatory part that you were talking about, that Henry Jenkins talks about, Amy, I think that's really interesting. You know, that fans are, they're taking these ideas and the stories and the themes, and they're doing their own things with it. I think that's equally interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of talk about what our favorite ways are to engage in Harry Potter fandom. We all have some accoutrement. We all have some swag, some Harry Potter swag we're rocking. But what are some of the things that you most like to do in terms of participating in the fandom? Louise?
Well, to be honest, my favorite thing is to come to festivals like this and give talks and hear other people's talks, because it is just a great, exciting day. You get to be engaged on such a intellectual level, but also just have a lot of fun.
And last weekend you were at the Queen City.
Yes. Magic Festival. I actually coordinated the academic programming for that, and actually Lana was one of our guests there, and we had a number of other speakers from the Mary Baldwin faculty, and it was a great time there. And it's a festival, you know, very similar to this one in terms of, you know, the downtown merchants getting involved and lots of decorations and a generic name. We're Queen City Mischief and Magic. We were once the Queen City Potter Party, but no more. But I don't know. It's a time of the community coming together and just engaging in dressing up, just having a lot of fun with this, but then also just getting to sit down with people who are very serious about the books and talk about them. And that's what is the most fun. In terms of other ways that I engage, I own some Harry Potter cookie cutters, so I actually make Harry Potter cookies. I have a sorting hat, and I have all the house crests. I have a few things like that. It's interesting. I was part of a group at Mysticon that were actually doing like homemade crafts, making homemade Christmas ornaments and things like that, and swapping them. So that's a really interesting component of it to me, that a lot of people seem to enjoy making homemade things that are in involved with Harry Potter, and then swapping, trading.
Yeah, I saw a little girl here had made a snitch, for example, mm-hmm. as part of the crafts that she was engaged with.
So HogwartsProfessor.com viewers, readers will know that I am something of a Harry Potter mixologist, because I did a video for Hogwarts Professor a few years ago with some of my drink recipes, but that is my favorite thing to do when I'm not, you know, giving papers at festivals and conferences like this one, is to my friends and I used to make up drinks based on like the potions or just references to. So like we had, you know, Felix Felicis, you know, which was this, it was kind of like this version of a royal gin fizz. And let me tell you, that'll make you feel lucky. You top that thing with champagne and all of a sudden you can't go wrong. You know, we had this one, we called it, it was a grasshopper basically, but we called it, I can't remember what we called it. It was that stuff that was supposed to be in the basin that Dumbledore had to drink. It's like, this is terrible, but here we are drinking it.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It was,
I'll be dead when I'm done with this drink.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
You feel surprisingly a lot better than that. When you finished it.
All right.
If you like grasshoppers. Yeah. If you don't, you know, you're in trouble, but yeah, that's my favorite. Endless possibilities.
Awesome. Lana, what about you?
That's a really hard question for me to answer, because I love the festival experience, and I like not only hearing everybody's talks, but also participating in panels and listening to panels. Teaching is one of my favorite ways to engage. And I think it is engaging also in Harry Potter fandom because students are generally so passionate about that. My very favorite thing to do, though, I think, is teaching the class that I've taught for about 10 years now in a middle school enrichment program. And this is an academic class. I want to say that in case the Rowling's legal Death Eaters are listening to our podcast. It is an academic experience. But we play Quidditch, and I make them butterbeer, and they... You know, occasionally there's a student who wants to pretend that he is Draco Malfoy for the duration of the week. And regardless of what I tell them to call me, they call me headmistress for the entire week because they just really want to pretend that they're at Hogwarts and I don't have to grade anything.
That sounds awesome.
It is awesome.
Like the best teaching experience ever.
It is awesome.
And learning.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah, that's right. There's a purity to that. What about you, Amy? Engaging with fandom?
Like everyone else, teaching the class, I've never really taught the Harry Potter class the same way twice when I've taught my course. So I like retooling to bring new materials in and to see what the students are most interested in. And, of course, writing and works and of criticism and trying to look at Harry Potter in different ways from through different lenses. But I'm also very interested in participatory culture, so I'm an active consumer in fan podcasts and for a long time Wizard Rock, and I look at fan fiction and fan art and see what I can find there, and I found lots of interesting things there. So.
You gave me my first Harry and the Potters CD.
A badge of pride.
I remember that. I remember that. Yeah. You know, I'm really interested in a lot of the fan creativity that goes into these little videos that, you know, get get passed around. And I can't believe some of the things that people put together. They're parodies or it's a song with a music video that goes along with it. Some of the fan fiction is really stunning. Really amazing stuff going on there in the fandom that is genuinely participating in the conversation about these characters. Really,
it seems like the quality is improving, especially over like the fan film. I don't know. I saw something a few months ago where it was like, you know, you really couldn't tell it apart from a professional. I mean, it was like really watching the ninth Potter movie. It was just so intensely, you know, professional and well thought out. And yeah, so it is amazing.
There are these people who are, there's a term for it. I can't remember it right now, but they are doing things, editing the films as in a way to tell the story differently. There's one, it's called the Boy Who Never Lived. And they take Harry out of one of the films but they have to make some choices to, you know, if Harry's not doing it, who's doing it? And it changes it, but it's an interesting experiment, right? It's an interesting thought experiment to sort of think about what is Harry's role, and if Harry's not doing it, then who could be doing it? And I think there's something, it would never occur to me to do that. I think that's really creative, and it makes you think about it, which I really appreciate. Have any of you ever done fan pilgrimages? We had a podcast about doing a fan pilgrimage. Lana has done one.
Not with regard to Harry Potter, but I did go on a Hunger Games fan tour in Western North Carolina a few years ago, and it made me want to have those folks take my whole Harry Potter class on their Harry Potter fan tour to England. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That's fun.
One of my sons went with me, and I lay under that shelf where Peter hides himself, you know, when he smears himself with mud and everything. And after I got into position, the tour guide told the story of the time somebody got in there, and it turned out there was a water snake under the ledge.
No.
Yeah, I think she does that every time.
Too much reality there. Too much.
Yeah.
And Emily, you've done fan pilgrimage?
Well, a long time ago, when the films were pretty new. I mean, I think that maybe we only had three or four films at the time. A friend of mine and I were going to be in Oxford, visiting some people. And so we looked at all the Oxford sites that, where the Harry Potter films were made. And so that was really neat. And we got to kind of play pretend and then take lots of pictures and create funny captions. And it was great.
That's cool. And of course there's all this theater now. There's of course Star Kids, Harry Potter musical. And what is it? The one that's the Hufflepuffs. I can't remember.
Puffs.
It's called Puffs.
Puffs.
I've heard wonderful things about that. Really some cool stuff going on.
I saw Potted Potter on Broadway, or I guess it was off Broadway when I saw it, but I saw that a few years ago, and that was hysterically funny.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and I guess like Potter Puppet Pals and all of those things. Like, I'm amazed by the creativity and the time that people put into that. I just think that represents some dedication. Well, let's talk about what we saw at the, you know, magical education part of the festival today and the things that we liked the best, the things that we think we are going to take home with us. Amy, what are some things that really resonated with you that you feel like you enjoyed the most, or that you're going to take with you when you go home?
What a fantastic experience this has been. One of the big thrills for me was meeting scholars whose work I've taught, whose work I've used in my own work, who I know from their ideas, even have corresponded with them for some time, but have never met face-to-face. And I was able to have in-person conversations with them and talk across our different disciplines and across our different interests, and also saw several really outstanding presentations, scholarly talks of works in progress that now are my, you know, to-watch list for works that will be published in the future. I appreciate the chance to see it, see these pieces as they're being worked through and as they're in their formative stages. And I just love the sense of community and family, seeing people with their children, seeing people across generations coming together to talk, and seeing great questions of terrific speakers from children as well as from adults. And I just love the creativity that goes into fan experience. So last night at the feast, the costumes people wore, the smallest details, even about the way that the room was set up, there was so much love and so much attention to detail just for the love of it, just for the celebration of something that we have as a common language together. And that's so affirming, because we're all coming from different places. We have, different concerns. We've been trained in different fields. But we all have this common language together. And I get so much energy from seeing the amount of creativity and attention and love poured into these kinds of events, and this one has been just phenomenal. So I feel very fortunate to have spent the last 2 days as a part of this event.
Yeah, I think you can see there's a lot of, people bringing themselves to it, and there's something really exciting about that. Louise, Absolutely. What about you?
Well, today I think one of the coolest experiences was I drove up to the church, was it Green Memorial United Methodist, where we had our talks today. I arrived about 9, and that was just when the church bells were starting to play the Harry Potter music on it. It was just beautiful. I'm walking up to this church, and these church bells are going off, and it's like you're walking into the set of a movie or something like that. It was just, and then of course we had the choir that sang at right before Amy's talk, and they were wonderful too. So, having the musical touches was a big treat.
Yeah, I agree. Like it evoked it, and I mean, some of that music's pretty tough, and they did such a great job. Mm-hmm. Lana, what about you?
Well, I just wanted to add that the festival is really grateful to the folks at Green Memorial, because they opened up their very large church to us, and they have some wonderful space for presenting in there, and some really talented people, including Brandon Mock, who directed that choir and also programmed the music for the bells. The minister there is just getting ready to launch a sermon series for the month of October called Biblical Values and the Boy Who Lived. So they're sort of continuing that conversation with the community. And by the way, you'll be able to listen to the sermons online when they eventually are there. It's deeply weird to be at a festival like this and be inside the same building all day long and not have much sense of what's going on out in the streets. And that's probably the part that I like least, although I would not choose to do anything different. But for me, this afternoon, I moderated a panel with some 20 and 30-something folks that I've known for most of their lives, with a couple of exceptions, who talked about what Harry Potter means to them and what it was like to grow up in the generation of kids who were about the same age when the Harry Potter series started coming out. And that was a really moving experience for me. One of the panelists, for example, told the story of crying through the entire 7th and 8th film adaptation, both halves of Deathly Hallows. And she said, I realized when I had finished watching these films, my childhood was over.
Wow.
And that's such a powerful statement, I think, about the extent to which those particular young people who have an experience that nobody else can really have, I think, you know, that experience is kind of isolated now for their, some people call them Generation Hex, I think. Right.
John says that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's isolated for them. Another of the panelists called Harry Potter the fable of his youth. He said, it's kind of the fable of my youth. And he talked about what he learned about it, about good and evil and dealing with people who are very flawed, and thinking about that now as a person who is, I guess, 30-ish, and how it's different now, to his ideas about that now, how they're different from what he, the ways that he interacted when he was not even a teenager yet.
Yeah, that is, as you said, that's such a, it's a special experience. It's going to be unique to that particular generation. I bet one of the things that people who were there will walk away with were related to Amy's keynote. She was talking about the value of fantasy and why it's not just for kids, it's for adults as well. And I think that sort of burgeoning adulthood is a perfect time. But I mean, I read them as adults, as did you, Amy, I know. So one of the things that you did was you gave us some suggestions for, you know, what's the next Harry Potter? Although you were suggesting that we should, you know, we shouldn't be just looking for the next Harry Potter, but we should be looking for the next thing that is giving us the consolation and the recovery and the escape that we get from fantasy stories. And I wondered if you could share with us what were some of your recommendations so that our listeners can get on Amazon or their favorite book site and order some things that they might find resonate, hit the same kind of chords as Harry Potter.
Well, I think we're at a very exciting moment. So I could have gone on all day with recommendations, but I limited myself to four, and I tried to imagine works that that did fulfill those same qualities and that Harry Potter gave us and inspired that same kind of empathy and hope and courage that reading the coming of age story of Harry Potter gave us. And so I ended up with four works, all of which include young adult protagonists that are, you know, both fantasy stories and coming of age stories, all from different places, drawing on mythology and folklore and deep magic from different places. So the Greyland trilogy by the Greyland duology by Pádraig O'Gillean from Ireland, which include The Call from 2016 and The Invasion from 2018, just fantastic work. The Legacy of the Orisha series, which began this year with Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi, who's been called by Entertainment Weekly the next Harry Potter, or properly Entertainment Weekly said, is this the next Harry Potter? Is this the next J.K. Rowling, being Adeyemi herself? Fantastic debut novel to that series. Also another fantastic debut novel to a new series, The Poppy War, which kicks off the Poppy War series. Also 2018 by R.F. Kuang, drawing on the Opium Wars in China to build that fantasy world. And lastly, the Sixth World series, kicked off by Trail of Lightning, by Rebecca Roanhorse, representing Navajo storytelling in the Navajo Nation. Another 2018 work, and of Pádraig O'Gillean's duology is completed. All the rest are new series, and all three of those series have book twos that are available for pre-order, so we can see the next book on the horizon. It's not a an open-ended question. The next books are coming. So I suggested that those would be great places to start to see the kind of depth and breadth of publishing that kind of fits in the Harry Potter tradition.
Right, and maybe some, you know, maybe there are opportunities for the next generations in those series as they pick them up and are inspired by them.
Exactly.
Yeah, and your keynote was wonderful, of course. I also really enjoyed Emily's talk, which was about house elves, which, of course, is a favorite topic of mine, but house elves and robots.
Yes.
Which was really interesting, and it was built on the idea that both the house elves and robots in science fiction are created servants.
Yes, yes. Sort of this part of this broader trope of, you know, what science fiction starts out asking. What if we could create, you know, sentient beings that basically we don't have to worry about their enslavement, you know, because they're made for this. They're created to be servants. And what if this were the case? And so the more I paid attention to this trope in some of the works of science fiction that I've read, the more I started identifying this trope with house elves. Because they're not like elves in other stories. They're not that kind of elf. They're not like Tolkien's elves. They're not like Victorian elves. They're really they behave much more like robots, even in the sense that they're governed by really strict rules, the way that, robots are. So they bring up, they're not just there to take up space in the narrative. They invite the characters and the reader to consider, human rights, to consider creaturely rights, you know, to consider what kind of rights, in their first conception in the early 1900s, they were a direct reference to serfdom, you know, to the peasant class, the laboring class, and they invited consideration of that in an era where human rights we were meant to be progressing with regard to human rights, and they still invite and invoke, you know, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion within the narrative itself and then also outside the narrative. And you, Katie, have done brilliant work on kind of likening them to, using feminist theory to liken them to housewives or like unliberated women who are kind of stuck in gendered roles that relate to domesticity. And I kind of took that and ran with it with regard to house elves and robots and how. But the most interesting thing is the role that women play, both in stories about robots and with house elves, in kind of recognizing them as having rights and encouraging them to seek their own liberation. And so we see that in classic stories with robots quite a lot. And then we see that in Harry Potter. And of course, their spokesperson being Hermione Granger. So it was a whole lot of fun. And then I also got to do a lot of shopping for like robot t-shirts, because I always feel like you need that kind of visual aid when you're talking about robots. I would also just like to say that this is the first time some speakers acknowledge that they had never spoken in a church before, like given a talk in a church before. I've given lots of talks in churches, but I've never given talks about robots in churches. So that was the first for me, and I really enjoy it. I've checked that off my bucket list now. Go right in churches and talk about robots.
Now Lana Whited and I are joined by Kristen Church, a partner at Gentry Lock Attorneys in Roanoke, Virginia, whose practice includes a focus on intellectual property. She's currently re-experiencing the magic of Hogwarts through the eyes of her two children, and her family recently visited the Wizarding World at Universal Studios. She was part of the Magical Copyright Enforcement Panel at the Roanoke Generic Magic Festival. Thanks for joining us, Kristen.
Well, thank you for having me.
We had such an interesting and informative session at the festival, which is one of many that has had to change its name and many of its events because of cease and desist notices from either J.K. Rowling's lawyers or Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers seems to be the one doing most of the festival cease and desisting. Our panel at the Roanoke Generic Magic Festival featured Kristen as well as Lana, who's one of the organizers of the Roanoke Magic Festival, and Patrick McCauley, who is one of the organizers of the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill College. And we had a really great conversation about that, and I'm so glad you all are here to help pass that along to our podcast listeners. So first, Kristen, can you help us understand why are so many of these festivals getting cease and desist notices?
Well, you know, I don't know what's really triggered this flurry of cease and desist letters that we have seen sent by particularly Warner Brothers. J.K. Rowling, Warner Brothers, the Harry Potter franchise has always been pretty active in making sure their intellectual property rights were enforced. We've seen that for a number of years. But I'm not sure what's triggered these cease and desist letters that have been coming out. It may be an increased prevalence in some of these fan-related activities that really have brought it on to the radar of Warner Brothers. And as a copyright and trademark owner, there are some requirements that those owners are required to, you know, steps that they're required to take to make sure that they are protecting their IP. And so they may feel like something has happened that, makes them be in a position where they actually need to take action. But I'm not sure what event or events triggered this flurry of activity we've seen.
So, Kristen, can you help us understand this? Because I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the idea is that if they don't want to lose their ability to control and have ownership of, you know, words like Harry Potter or the lightning bolt symbol, then if they don't actually try to limit that and try to have control of it themselves, they may lose control, right? So they have to do some, you know, they have to do some policing for themselves so that they do maintain intellectual control of those.
Yes, and that's part of the concern. Anytime you're a brand owner or you own intellectual property, you're wanting to maintain control of that, because there's this concept that if you kind of let it go too far beyond your controlling aspects and you let others do what they want without any sort of policing for a period of time, then you may not be able to, as the owner of that trademark or that brand, be able to, you know, once the horses have been let out, you know, how can you kind of bring them back into the stable? And so one of the questions is, where do you kind of start to cross that line? And so anytime you're moving away from a particular list of, you know, if there's a license, generally if there's a license involved, the trademark or brand owner will have very specific limitations on how someone other than the brand owner can use those names. Just like Warner Brothers likely has a very detailed license agreement with J.K. Rowling or with other companies associated with the Harry Potter franchise. That's something that they'd be looking to do with anyone who's using these trademark and owned names, logos, characters, etc., so that they can keep control and maintain the value, essentially, of the Harry Potter franchise and the branding that they have.
Right, so you've got all these fans who are excited by the festivals, and one of the problems, I guess, with the festivals is that there's a profit element to them, right? It's not just somebody who's writing a satire or a parody or somebody who's doing it for their own enjoyment, but it is sort of turning a profit with some of these festivals.
Right. And with a number of things, like, for example, with copyright, there are fair use exceptions that would allow someone to use terms and names for educational purposes. If there was parody involved, you know, there are certain exceptions for a copyright owner having the ultimate control and usage of that copyright material. But anytime you have any sort of for-profit activity involved, and sometimes even not-for-profit activity can generate some questions, because there's often a for-profit element on the fringes. But particularly when there's for-profit activity, we see copyright trademark owners start to, you know, kind of, let's put the lid on this, let's rein things back in so that we can make sure that we're not letting this dilution and use of this owned branding that we have get beyond the bounds of something that we can control. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, the Harry Potter franchise and particularly the fan activity, there has been quite a bit of growth in that over the past few years. There is the the Wizarding World in Florida and in California, but there's kind of limited outlets for that currently. And so it may be that Warner Brothers was kind of surprised at the level of interest and number of festivals that have popped up over the last few years.
Lana, let's bring you into the conversation here. You have done the Roanoke Festival 2 years now, and the first year it was the Harry Potter Fest, right?
It was Roanoke Harry Potter Festival, right.
But you received a notice that you had to change the name. Can you tell us, you know, why do you think there has been this surge of suppression? Do you have a sense for why that might be?
I suspect that Kristen is right, that it has something to do with the proliferation of festivals. We got our letter from Warner Brothers late last winter. And, you know, I'm in Virginia, as you said. Without thinking hard, I could name four festivals that have derived from the Harry Potter franchise that I could drive to within, say, 3 hours. They vary in size. Initially, I think all of them used Harry Potter or Potter. Initially, the festival in Stanton was Queen City Potter Party. Ours was Roanoke Harry Potter Festival. Not sure about the original name of the festival in Scottsville, Virginia. But there's a smaller festival in a community called Strasburg. I know that all or most of those groups have also received letters in approximately the same time frame we did. One of the things we know is that the folks who were corresponding with us had seen our social media. There was some evidence that perhaps there was even someone on the ground at our festival in May 2017, just because of some of the references in the correspondence. I mean, I think they were looking very closely at festivals, and that's probably about the right time frame for that to have appeared on their radar for them to have begun responding to festivals. So, you know, I have a suspicion that it's just the timing of that. I know that the festival in Scottsville, Virginia actually skipped a year after they received their first letter to kind of regroup and think about their response. It happened coincidentally that we were asked by Downtown Roanoke, which initially was involved in our festival, to move from May to October, and that gave us about an additional 5 months between festivals and a little more time to think about that. All these festivals are in the fall, all in late September or October. I think it's fairly common for them to be timed around Halloween or shortly before. And I'm guessing that it's just the growth of that kind of festival experience that has caused that to happen. One of the ways in which that affects us is that we've added language, for example, to our vendor contracts about not violating copyright. I certainly have walked around a lot at festivals like this and also at smaller events and seen some things on vendor displays that I think would violate the copyright. And in some cases, it's kind of difficult to decide about that. For example, if a pendant has the word always on it, I don't think that's inherently a violation of Rowling's trademark because she certainly didn't invent that word. When you combine that word with an image of a doe, for example, or a lightning bolt in the background or something that does suggest the significance of that word in the Harry Potter series, then I think things get more complicated.
That's really interesting. So let me ask Kristen, like, how worried should people be? The conference organizers, the vendors, the, you know, even the fans who are, you know, potentially getting in the way of some of these copyright and trademark issues. You know, how big is the threat, Kristen?
Well, you know, certainly those that are associated with the Harry Potter franchise have made it clear that they are not squeamish about enforcing their intellectual property rights. But ultimately, any trademark or brand owner is not really looking to be in a lot of litigation. And right. so primarily what they're looking to do through the use of these cease and desist letters is an education of the public to kind of, you know, gently and but firmly remind folks of the brand owner's rights and to draw attention to those instances that they may become aware of where they feel like there has been a line crossed into infringement. You know, it's in Harry Potter, the franchise's interest to increase this, as we see this generational shift of, you know, new Harry Potter fans, to increase that activity and the love of the Harry Potter brand. I mean, certainly my children were one of the main factors into why we visited the Wizarding World of Harry Potter in Florida when we visited with Disney World. And so it's kind of it's a balancing act between a brand owner, because you certainly want to encourage fans to read the books, to, you know, explore the increasing ways that J.K. Rowling and Warner Brothers are, you know, increasing the Harry Potter franchise through Fantastic Beasts and through related books that J.K. Rowling has been publishing from the encyclopedia and other sorts of models. And so they want to increase fan buy-in into the franchise, but they do want to, you know, avoid kind of the rampant infringement of their brands and their trademarked property, so that, again, it's much more difficult once you've let that go unpoliced for a long period of time to then kind of rein things in.
Right. And, you know, you're reminding me that one of the things that Patrick McCauley had said about the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter experience was that he said that actually they were able to work with Warner Brothers, who was able to give them, you know, do this, don't do that kind of list. And so your emphasis on the educational quality of what they're doing, I think that, you know, that maybe is some of that, although I can imagine it's pretty frightening maybe getting one of those letters. It is supposed to intimidate you at least somewhat. So Lana, you started to tell us a little bit about some of the things that the Roanoke Festival did. Obviously you went for the bold name of generic magic festival. What are some things that festivals are doing to avoid the ire or the legal retribution of J.K. Rowling or Warner Brothers?
I just want to respond directly to your comment about our name, because I wanted to say that we chose it because at the very end of the letter that we received was the sentence, "We do not object to the concept of a generic magic festival." And we thought, well, there you go. We'll just take that. And we have in writing the fact that Warner Brothers doesn't object to that name. You know, obviously it's a little snarky. And I will tell you, my personal perception is that decision has been met with mixed responses. Some people think it's hilarious and they really like it. Other people are not so wild about it. I personally tend to fall into the latter category. And I will tell you that our t-shirt sales, I think, were a real casualty of that this year. We just didn't sell a lot of t-shirts compared to the first festival. And I think that's because people want to buy t-shirts with house names on them. We designated locations as sort of common rooms, which is another concept I think Rowling did not invent. We call them the red common room, the gold common room, the green castle, for example. So we sort of made the language a little more generic in that regard. And I think that's common with other festivals. The festival in Stanton is now called Queen City Mischief and Magic. And obviously none of those words are copyrighted or trademarked. I think the extent to which festivals are actually responding in terms of direct references to characters in the Harry Potter series or language from the Harry Potter series varies enormously. My personal perception is that Stanton is still using a fair amount. They still have events like Meet the Hogwarts Founders at these times, and they have four costumed actors who are Godric Gryffindor and Helga Hufflepuff and Rowena Ravenclaw and Salazar Slytherin. You can have your picture taken with Hagrid, or you can meet Hermione at a particular time. That doesn't seem like much in the way of modification to me. I would say the extent to which the Roanoke Festival modified things was fairly significant, certainly more significant than that. But I should also say, in characterizing the Stanton Festival, I was a participant in the educational events this year. I was not really in the streets a lot. So, you know, my perception is probably colored by that lack of experience. At the same time, when I'm participating in the Roanoke Festival, I'm primarily directing the educational events, and there are lots of things that happen in conjunction with our festival that I don't know about and don't experience. We did, again this year, have something kind of similar to house feasts. We changed the language a little bit. We had a choir perform.
And the choir was wonderful, by the way, Lana.
I thought it was really, they were a highlight of the festival. The choir was organized by Brandon Mock, who is at Green Memorial United Methodist Church, which hosted our educational events. And that was terrific because that church looks as much like a castle as anything in downtown Roanoke. So, you know, I think we made more modifications certainly than some people are making. What Patrick is suggesting about working directly with Warner Brothers and you know, asking lots of questions about what's kosher and what's not kosher. I think that's a response of a different sort. All those responses are valid. And I also wanted to remind you, Katie and Kristen, I have the special distinction of having been the recipient of 2 cease and desist letters now from Rowling's lawyers, because when I put together my first book of essays about Harry Potter, The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, that's when I received the first letter. And, you know, that correspondence, frankly, reflected some, I think, misunderstanding about what literary criticism is. The person who wrote to me, who is a fellow named Neil Blair, a Warner Brothers attorney, suggested that if there was any, I think he called it companion books about the Harry Potter series, those would be written by Rowling herself, which I think is deeply weird. As literary criticism goes, you know, it'd be like Faulkner writing volumes of criticism about Faulkner.
No.
But in that case, I just wanted to mention, in terms of responses to these letters, obviously that was a less frightening situation because what I was doing was clearly protected by fair use. I did consult some folks I knew who were experts in intellectual property. I kind of had this daydream of myself and Neil Blair talking about violating copyright on the Today Show, being refereed by Katie Couric. Obviously, that never happened. But what we did do, and I think this is kind of an interesting response, what I did do is, using the figure of about 5% as a fair use benchmark, we added together, we determined the total number of words in each of the 7 volumes of the Harry Potter series. And I made certain, literally counting words, that in all the essays in The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, we didn't quote more than 5% of the total number of words in any one novel in the Harry Potter series. That's a pretty close and specific kind of response, I think.
I think that some other edited anthologies are also doing similar things to that, Lana. So I think you were on the cutting edge of that, because I think that there have been some, especially publisher concerns about, you know, quoting too much material. But mm-hmm. I do think I sort of hope the educational and the critical quality of what's happening there would, as you say, put that sort of firmly in fair use. I think that's one of the reasons that the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill, the conference part that it goes with the festival, they've been able to keep their name Harry Potter Academic Conference because they've intentionally put the academic part in, and it is an academic setting where we're doing criticism.
That makes sense to me. It is a point of pride with me that collection, The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, is one of few books that came out at that time that does not have a stamp anywhere on its cover that says this book is not approved by J.K. Rowling. Because, you know, it just seems to me that to expect that reflects their some assumption that those books would be approved by J.K. Rowling unless they suggest otherwise. And I think regardless of the scope of a franchise, that's a ridiculous kind of notion.
Well, and this kind of, I think, brings up this question of, you know, where the, you want to respect the intellectual property of whether it's J.K. Rowling, who I have a little more sympathy for than Warner Brothers, but either way, you want to respect their intellectual property. They're, as you said, Kristen, they're kind of having to manage their brand and make sure that they have control of it. And then, you know, where do we allow room for fan energy and creativity and critique? And so when we think about the impact that the copyright and trademark restrictions might have on fan culture, Lana, what do you think about that? Do you think it's going to suppress fans' abilities to engage, whether it is, you know, creatively or just for their own amusement or critically with the Harry Potter series? Is this going to suppress that fan movement, or do you think that nothing can suppress Harry Potter fandom?
Well, I frankly think that nothing can dim the passion, because I think people who really love Harry Potter really love Harry Potter. And I, you know, I don't personally believe that festivals such as ours are a threat to Rowling's right to profit from the copyrights and the trademarks that she holds. You know, if anything, I think it's a boost to that. We know, for example, that fans who come to festivals are buying all kinds of copyrighted and trademarked merchandise, to, you know, robes and wands and all those kinds of things. I don't see it as likely to have that effect. I do think it will have more influence on the structure of the festivals and the naming, and probably certainly on the publicity. I mean, I will say I do some of the Facebook Live events for our festival and some of the social media posts, and I was certainly more conscious of what I was writing and what I was posting this year. Case in point, the week before the festival, Green Memorial's bells were playing Harry Potter theme music. And for one of those Facebook Live events, I recorded some of that music. I didn't record the whole thing because I'm aware that how much you use of a copyrighted work is part of the whole concept of whether you're violating the copyright. So we were more likely to publish little snippets of things than to publish, say, an entire performance of a piece of music or something like that. So I think it will have an effect, but as I said at the beginning of this of comment, I don't think it'll dim the passion.
Communication scholar, fan studies expert Henry Jenkins actually sort of thinks that Warner Brothers maybe misunderstands what fans are about, and your comment just reminded me of that. That he basically argues that fans don't get saturated with fan experiences, that they actually get motivated to do more. So just because you go to the Roanoke Festival doesn't mean that you're going to say, "Oh, I went to that one, so I don't need to go to Universal Studios Wizarding World." I mean, that doesn't happen. You're probably even more likely to want to make that trip. So that there's some way in which, you know, as you say, the fans are going to continue to want to have those fan experiences, but maybe with a little more mindfulness. Kristen, as we kind of wrap up here, where do you see this going in the future? Do you think that there might be a pendulum swing back so that fans are allowed a little bit more play, or do you think that Warner Brothers and J.K. Rowling are going to continue to want to, you know, make sure that those key characters and names and symbols are fully within Rowling's and Warner Brothers' control?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of as you and Lana were talking about, you know, fans will find a way. And so there is an expectation, I think, that Warner Brothers and J.K. Rowling should have an expectation that fans are going to find ways to celebrate, you know, the characters that J.K. Rowling has created. And so what we may see, maybe we'll see more of these Wizarding Worlds that will pop up, more likely. Perhaps we'll see an actual structure where Warner Brothers may license the rights to organizations around the country to have these kind of Warner Brothers-sanctioned events. Mm. where there will be a list of requirements so that the brand owner, Warner Brothers and J.K. Rowling, can make sure that the Harry Potter franchise is being utilized in a way that doesn't tarnish or diminish their branding, but that will allow fans to participate fully, and especially those who don't have the ability to travel. So that might be an option, and we've seen that certainly with, I believe I mentioned during the panel, the Polar Express, where there are a number of Polar Express events, particularly around the holidays, where those are actually licensed and official, you know, authorized events that take place and allow children and families to participate in the Polar Express experience. So maybe we'll see something like that in the future.
I might just reiterate, I think the point that Kristen made really early about how people who are doing legal work have a certain duty to kind of remind the general public, to remind people of the importance of protecting the copyright. I think that's a really important point. I mean, I personally think that the attorneys who work for Rowling are not really Death Eaters, although I certainly have called them that in joking. You know, I've used the phrase Rowling's legal Death Eaters. Honestly, I think they're more like those Ministry of Magic employees who are really just kind of doing their job and earning their pay and kind of, you know, performing that due diligence of doing what they have to do to remind the public that the copyrights are there and have to be protected. So I think that's a really important point. And it goes right a long way toward answering that question, why now, why so much response?
What a great note to end our conversation on. And so I just wanted to thank you once again for a really thought-provoking conversation about copyright, trademark, and the fan experience. Thanks very much. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site. And this includes our liaison with MuggleNet, Renee McBrien, who is helping us with our social media. Speaking of which, listeners, we are glad you joined us today, and we would love it if you would engage with us on social media. We have a Facebook page. We are at Read, Write, Roll on Twitter. And you can also send your thoughts to us at our email account, readingwritingrolling@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Now, listeners, I will leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time, when we'll be using our words to make some magic!